If I could ask everyone's attention, we're going to go ahead and get started. Hopefully everyone on the live meeting is able to hear us also. If you're listening out there in the internet land, we've been reading your questions in between while Steve was talking. Myself, Sarah, and Osley from Microsoft, we're all in the Q&A room answering questions online too. Keep the questions coming. I won't be answering these because I'll be talking now, and then everyone else will answer the questions for me. If we get any good ones, we'll take them there. The purpose of this next session is really to focus on understanding some of the newer syntaxes in C Sharp 3.0. Now, I'll go ahead and ask a question. Well, before I do that, C Sharp today is not your father's C Sharp. It's not the same C Sharp that first came out in 2001 when .NET was introduced. There's been a lot of changes, a lot of innovations in the languages that have come out over the past couple of years. And a lot of folks who are doing C Sharp development probably might not have adopted some of these new syntax things because you're familiar with the way of doing things that you've always been in, and they still work and they always will. So why not just stick with that, right? So MVC is going to force you to take a look at some of these newer syntaxes because the framework makes extensive use of them. And you'll see that throughout a lot of the code samples and code demos throughout the day here. So that's kind of what we want to do, is go through all this stuff. So let me just reintroduce myself. I said my name's Peter Ligotti. I'm a developer evangelist at Microsoft, and I do a couple things to talk to the outside world. I speak to folks via my blog. I blog about developer events that go on throughout the New York, New Jersey metropolitan area. So for everyone in the room, this is a local resource to check out. For those of you guys online, you can read it too. The other thing I recently started is a new podcast called The Connected Show. I started this with one of my colleagues named Dimitri Lyland, and we publish a show about every 2 weeks. We talk about the latest news going on in the Microsoft development community, and then we usually have a guest on to talk about some different technology. Our focus on the show is around interoperability with Microsoft and non-Microsoft technologies, but also newer stuff like cloud computing, like Windows Azure, and a lot of the stuff that's going on in that space. And of course, I'm on Twitter at Jersey Shore without the vowels. You can see that there at the bottom. So how many people in the room know what this symbol is? Not a greater than or equal operation. So that's less than half the room raised their hand. I don't know about how many people are online. Does this symbol scare you? Does it worry you? It's okay to raise your hand for that, because it did for me. When I first saw it, I didn't know what was going on. That symbol is called the lambda symbol, and it's something that you use when forming a lambda expression. Now you're probably thinking your head's already starting to explode. Don't worry, I'm going to try to explain it to you and bring it home. So when you look at code like this, does it make you feel like that? You know, if you're not used to seeing that type of syntax out there. So we're going to talk about this. This is some generic code, writing some generic objects. So all this stuff is really just syntactic sugar. It's new ways of writing code that you could have written in C# 1 in the old way, except we're giving you a way to do it a lot easier with a lot less code at the end of the day. That's the real goal of all this stuff. So to talk about the features that we're going to cover, I kind of have this agenda slide up there, and I'm using some of the syntaxes that are in C# 3.0. So we have a list of features in the language that we're going to go through. Talking about generics and anonymous methods, these are things that were introduced in .NET 2.0, but then a lot of the other features such as local type inference and the object initializers and lambda expressions, these are all things that were introduced in .NET 3.5 in C# 3.0. Now, while I'm going through this, and most of the code today is all in C#, I want you to know that there are equivalents for all of these features in Visual Basic. Unfortunately, I'm not going to have time to cover them or show you code samples on that today. But that is kind of the goal, and we want to show you how that relates back to MVC. So the first thing I want to talk about is generics. So just by show of hands, how many people in the room are familiar with generics and using them? Okay, that's good. That's the majority of the room. And the reason why is because if you weren't, then I'd have a lot of work to do here. Because this, everything is based very heavily on generics. But for those who don't know what generics are, in the .NET framework, there is the collections class. And in there, there's all sorts of common programming collection items you find, like array lists, stacks, queues, all those types of things, dictionary objects. And these things typically deal in terms of generic or just plain old objects. I don't want to say generic, just the base object type. So you can put anything into them. So in this example here, without using a generic, I have a stack. Let's say we had a stack class, and we're going to be able to put any type of object we want onto it. So on the left-hand side of the screen, and let me see if I got my pointer works here. Hey, it does. There we go. So on the left side of the screen here, we create a new stack, and we're going to call it employees. And the goal is we'll put some employees onto this stack and be able to do that. So I can say, call the push method on the stack and push in a new employee object. But now when I want to get an employee off the stack, where I pop it off the stack, I have to cast it back to an employee. That's because when it's in the stack as an object. It's not in there as an employee object. It has to be cast back. Same thing over here on the right. Now let's say I have on this side another stack. This will be a stack of, we'll call it sizes, and we'll put some numbers because it'll be an integer-based stack, or at least that's what we want to use it for as a programmer. So the same thing, I can push on the number 42 on the right here, and when I pop it off, I have to cast it back as an integer. Now, what happens if I do this next line of code over here? Now I have another push command. I push on number 77, and then I push on an employee object. That's going to work because the stack takes type object. But now down here when I'm popping things off, the first thing I go to pop, I cast it back to an integer. That's going to compile okay, but at runtime that's going to throw an exception. And that's because the cast is not valid because I'm trying to cast an employee object into an integer. And obviously you wouldn't be able to do something like that. So that's a problem with having things being object-based. So if you look here, here's kind of a view of that with the stack. What we're doing when you push things onto the stack, looking at the bottom and the left side of the screen, you're essentially boxing and unboxing things as you put them on. So that's what all the casting is, going back and forth. And it has a lot of complications with that. Number one, there's a performance overhead to doing the casting back and forth. And then also, as you saw, the compile time, you don't get any errors. You get a runtime error. It's very hard to debug that type of code or find that, which is harder in production. Well, with generics, we have the ability to declare a collection to be of a certain type. And then it's a strongly typed object. So we can have a strongly typed stack class that takes type employee. That's the only thing it takes. So when we put something onto the stack, in this case in the diagram here, we push an integer in there. The only thing going in there is integers. And what's coming out is going to be an integer too. I don't have to cast it back to something else. So that gives me a lot of flexibility and improvement in what I can do with my code. So here's that same code after we have generics. So here, you can see when I declare the stack class, I use this syntax with the bracket symbols. So it's a stack, and then it's open bracket, employee, close bracket. And that's basically I'm passing into the constructor of the type, the constructor of the stack object, the type of data that I want that stack to hold. And then when I go to push an object onto, that looks the same. I push something on. But when I pop it, there's no casting because I'm going to get back an employee object. I can just take that out. Now over here on the right, I can create a stack of integers. And there in the brackets, I pass an integer as the type that I want the stack class to hold. And again, I don't have to cast. But now down here, if I try to push an employee onto the integer stack, I'm going to get a compile time error. So the compiler is going to tell me that in Visual Studio at that time. So I'm going to find that type of error up front. There's no issues there. So that's going to save me time from that perspective. And again, because I'm not doing the boxing and unboxing, I get a lot of performance benefits that come along with that. Now, with generics, not only do you get a whole slew of classes that are in the .NET framework library. So here you get things like list, dictionary, stack, queue. You get these interfaces that you can go off and create your own generic objects to put your own types in. So if you want to build your own custom collection classes, you can do that. And in a lot of the things you might do with MVC, when you're bringing data back from the model, you might be creating your own custom classes that are going to be generics. Excuse me. So other things you can do, you can put constraints on what the types are. So you might create a list or create your own custom collection, but you only want it to be able to store objects of a certain type. So I can say, I'm going to create a collection that can only hold strings and integers, but it can't hold dates, or it can't hold this, that, or the other thing. So those are all things that you can do with generics. All right, so moving off the generics, we're going to move into some of the features now that are in C# 3 and in .NET 3.5. Again, feel free to ask questions because this is going to be sort of a dry topic, but we're going to try to make it fun. So this is typical declaration code we might see in C#. Nothing fancy here. So we're declaring a bunch of variables on the left there by putting their type, the variable name, and then setting some initial values on the right. Well, in C# 3, we have local variable type inference. And if you think about it, int I equals 666, it's almost redundant to write the word int there, because the compiler is going to look at that code, and it knows that 666 is an integer under the covers. So it could just assign the value to the variable I and say, oh, yeah, that's an integer, and I know, therefore, I must be an integer. So it can kind of figure that out for us. So what we can do is use this new thing called the var keyword. And the var keyword there, want to be clear, is not the same as variant. Does not mean variant or variable. So for all you JavaScript programmers out there, that's not the same thing as var in JavaScript. It's also, if we're looking in terms of Visual Basic, it's not the same as the dim statement. They're not the same thing there. So var basically means tell the compiler, look at the stuff on the right side of the operation there, of the assignment operation, the equal sign, and let that determine what the type of the variable on the left side is. So what it's going to do here, well, if you look at the code on the screen there, it saves you typing a couple of keystrokes, right? So on the int I equals 666, it's not saving you any keystrokes. Let's be honest there. On the dictionary declaration, it saves us a little bit. But here's where this is going to come into play. Sometimes when you're writing code, the stuff that's on the right side of the equal operator, you might not know what type it is yourself. It might be a type that's anonymous, which we're going to talk about in a second, a type that doesn't even exist. And therefore, you can't possibly declare the type on the left side when you're declaring the variable. And therefore, you can use this type inference to do that. So in general, there's a couple of things to know about the var keyword. You could go through all your code and use the var keyword like I've done here instead of doing it like you do the old way up on top. And all these statements equal the same thing. But it does become a little bit less human readable because it's not always clear what the intention is for someone reading the code of what variable that type is on the left. So you might want to stick to, for basic stuff, doing it way up on top. But when you get to some of these statements on the right, we're using anonymous types, or when we look at things like link, language integrated query, which I'll talk about in a little bit, that's going to bring back stuff from a database, that it's going to be a unique type that gets generated on the fly, then in that case, you need to use the var keyword. Questions so far? Everybody's quiet today, right? The caffeine's wearing out from breakfast? All right. So we have a couple other things here. This is another thing that helps when we're creating things. These next couple of things are about initialization, and this is stuff you're going to see in MVC. So we have automatic properties. So we've all written a class where we have private member variables, and then we have public fields that have getter and setter methods on them that go back and set the values of the private member variable. Right? So you can still do that, but as a shorthand code, you can do this here. So here I have a customer class that I've declared, a public field, it's a type string, and it's called name. And all I have to do is, after the word name, in curly brackets, just put get, semicolon, set, semicolon. And automatically, behind the scenes, it's going to store the value of that to a private member field that I don't have to write or declare. It's just going to do that for me. I could also, obviously, go in here and write longer getter and setter methods if I wanted to do something custom. But just for a simple field like that, I can just write that and be done with it. So a lot of times what you'll see when you do some of the view modeling and create some of the model objects in MVC, really easy for a simple class is to write this syntax a lot more shorthand. Now, another thing we've got in C# 3.0 is new object initializers. So here, this is an old way of doing things, typically. We have a public class called point, and this has the old format there, right? So we have a private member variable of x and y, and we have a public accessor there, the x and the y, that, and the getter and setters that set that up there, right? That's what you'd expect to be able to do there. Well, what you can also declare with that is when I go to instantiate that, I can say, create new points, and then curly brackets actually set the values of those internal fields, of those X and Y fields, right there on the declaration line. So I'm not having to go do things the old way, which might have been where I would declare the object and then have to, in a separate line of code, go and set the properties or the values of those fields. Here I can do it in one line of code, all right there and declare. So this is very common syntax we're going to see quite often in the frameworks when we're going along here. So pretty simple stuff, nothing too complex here. Now, likewise, not only can you do that for a single object, there's a customer one up on top, just like the one I showed before point, we can do this for a collection. So here I'm creating a list of customers, and in this list I can do curly brackets and then do just each value separated by a comma. I can actually do initialization within an initialization. So I'm initializing new customer objects with Homer Simpson and Frank Sinatra, but those are new properties in this customer list. So very easy just to generate things up like that. That's another common thing you'll see in the code. And I believe, see if you can tell me if I'm wrong, when you do the data stuff this afternoon, you're actually not going against a real database. You're just going to do some of this stuff to just gen up some fake data to work with. So very quick way to get things easily set up like that. All right, so another thing we've got is anonymous types. So following along that same syntax, if we look here, before we created a new customer and we had a name and an age. Here we have a name, Jenny, and an age 31. And notice what's missing there. I don't have the word customer. I just have the keyword new. This class, what type is this object? It doesn't have a type. It's an anonymous type. There's no class word. And therefore, when I declare the variable O on the left side of the equation there, I need to use the var keyword because I don't know what the type is. Type will be inferred by the compiler. So what's really going on under the covers here, when I write this line of code, is what's showing up in red there. I'm really declaring a class of XXX, no name, it's anonymous, and it's got two public properties on it that are being set. And then the var is really basically coming out to be the anonymous type. Now, once this code gets compiled, you could probably go in a reflector, inspect the DLL, and there'd be some cryptic name that is generated in the bytecode, but you're never going to do that. Now, pretty neat that you can do that. You're probably thinking, why would I want to do that? Right? Because you're not going to probably do this in everyday code, because that would make no sense. Because then how do you come back and refer to this thing at a later point in time? You don't. But what you'll see, this is used, again, in a lot of the MVC syntax, especially I'm going to show you when we set up the routing. We're going to use this syntax to pass values into the routing engine. So if you need to pass data in as a single object that's going to be called one time as an input parameter on another method, you might use this syntax to pass stuff in. It also helps us out when we're dealing with link and bringing back data from a database too. All right, let's get back to this Lambda guy here. So a lot of folks in the room said this confused them. And I will tell you that this confused me too. It confused me a lot. It took me a long time to get my head around it, but I think I finally figured it out. And what happens for me, or what finally made the light bulb go on, was to kind of see this in context in a real-world situation, because I just wasn't understanding what's going on. So I figured I'm going to tell you a little story today about it, and instead of doing a code demo in Visual Studio, I thought it was more effective to kind of put code snippets here on the slide that we'll step through that'll build this up and take us from the delegate operation into a Lambda. So before I start, let me ask, how many folks in the room are familiar with what a delegate is? Okay, that's a good number of you. So a delegate is, and this has been around since C# first came out, is the ability to basically pass a function as a parameter to another method. And then that function that you passed to the other method can call the method that you're passing to it. And that's a delegate. It would delegate the functionality back to the delegate that you passed into. So let's do this real world. So let's start out with a generic list of products. I'm already using generics again here, okay? So we have a list object, and it's going to be a list of type product. And in here, I'm going to initialize this up with about 6 different products. And you'd see in the list there, kind of have a Microsoft slant to that there. We have an Xbox 360. We have a Zune HD. We have a Zune 80 gigabyte. We have Windows 7, We have Surface, a couple of products in the list there. Now, the question becomes, I've got this list, it's in memory or it's wherever I retrieved it from a database. How do I find all the Zunes in that list? There are multiple ones in there. How would I get them out? Or how would I sort those products that were in the list? And if I were going to sort them, what am I sorting them by? Name, price, color? None of those were in the data that I put in there, but imagine if that was in the list, if a product had all those fields. You know, what is the sort? Some other criteria? How do I do that? Well, luckily, the generic list class in the .NET framework has a find all and a sort method. So what I'll do here is the next couple of slides is going to be showing you some pseudocode. So if we looked at the declaration of the list class, so let's say the implementation of the list class in the .NET framework, let's pretend that we could actually open up the code and look at it. Actually, we don't have to pretend because you actually can go look at the .NET framework source code. It is available out there. But for today's sake, let's pretend because it's a pseudocode. So if we look at the find all and the sort methods, they each take a parameter that you have to pass into it. And for the find all method, the parameter you have to pass in is what? What is it that you want the list operator, the find all method, to find? And the same thing for the sort method, how am I sorting this list? What am I comparing to put things in order by? So under the covers, these things are going to have to, we're going to have to somehow tell it what we want to find. So let's focus on the find all method. That's the scenario we're going to follow today, and dig a little deeper into the pseudocode. So I said we wanted to find all the Zunes that were in the product list. And if you remember, it was Zune HD, it was Zune 80, and it was Zune 30. And they were just strings. So I'm essentially need to check each product's name and then check if the name contains the string Zune. That's how I would determine that this is a Zune. So in theory, if we think about it, and if we read the comments there, the algorithm is probably inside the list operation, inside the find all method is go through the list, start iterating through it, examine each item in the list, compare it to the what, to this matching test, and then if we find a match, add it to my result list, and finally at the end we'll return a result list. So I think we're actually missing a little bubble, but okay. So let's take this pseudocode and make it a little bit more realistic. And I'm going to add some more generic syntax to it. So this is what the implementation might really look like here. So we're passing in a match test, which is something that's going to say, you know, how do we know if this thing matches, if it meets the criteria that we're looking for? We're going to create a generic list of T called the result list inside, first thing we do. We're going to do a for loop, and we're going to say for each item in this, and this means the main product list, the list you're doing the find all operation. We're going to say if the test, if the match test is true, if we found what it is we're trying to look for, add the item to the result list, and then, of course, at the end of the loop, return the result list, just like I showed there in the comments before. This is what the code looks like in more real life. But what is that matching test that we're going to pass in? It's really a delegate to a method somewhere else that's going to tell us how we look up and what we're comparing. And that method is going to get called each time we step through that for loop as we're iterating through the items in the list. Now, that's the key point to remember, is that we're going to pass in a method that gets called every time through the list. Because when you're using this in the real world, you might not ever see or know what the find all method does under the covers. Same thing for that sort method. You don't know what that code's doing under the covers, but you know that it, as it goes through the list, the sort thing, it's going to have to call your delegate, your method. So that's really what it is. Now, in our case, this is just a simple matching test. We're going to say, does this contain the word Zune in it or not? So we're going to get a true back or false. It's just going to return a bool. That's going to be the end case there. So if we were going to have a delegate, we'd have to declare a delegate signature of what the method would look like. And that method would have to take an object, which in our case would be the product object, and it would just return a bool. Very simple syntax there. Well, in the .NET framework, there's this thing called the predicate of T. And that is a really fancy generic delegate that's in the .NET framework. So since that's a signature that's common that a lot of people use, just take an object and return a bool. We don't care what you have to do to figure out if it's a bool or not. That's the signature we use. So that's, we have to declare a delegate of type predicate T. It's a generic there. And that is what the findAll method takes in the generic list class. That's the syntax. If we went to the MSDN library and we looked up the syntax of how you call the findAll method in the library there, we'd see that it takes a predicate of key. In this case, I'm calling it matchText. Now, what's under the covers there, the implementation of findAll, you wouldn't see that in the documentation, but you know, you can imply that's what's going on behind the scenes. Everybody okay? Questions? Nodding heads? All right. Now let's come back to finding all those zooms. All right, so now, assume we got that class I declared earlier, right? Created the list of products, okay? So here I've got some class. In it, I've got a main method, and I've got my list of products, except instead of bringing it back from where I declared it by hand, I'm maybe going off and calling it in the database, get product list. And now I have another product list here, a list of products, that's going to be called my zoom list. I'm going to get all the lists that have the zooms. And I'm going to take the original product list, I'm going to call findAll, and what I need to pass in is the what. What am I finding? Well, down here, I have another method called isAZoom. And it takes a product as input, and it basically returns if the product's name contains zoom. The name field, same property on the product object, so it contains zoom. Very simple method. And that method signature there, bool is a zoom, takes a product T, matches that predicate syntax. So what you're looking at here is the passing of the delegate. We're basically just saying we want to pass the is a zoom method into the find all. That's what's going on there from the syntax perspective. And we have to put this line in here so that we know that the predicate is of type product, that that's the generic type we're going to pass into it. So this syntax here might throw you a little bit, but that's what's going on. So the key point is that we're going to pass in this external method down here that's going to do the match to tell us what we're looking for. So now in .NET 2, C# 2, they introduced this thing called anonymous methods, which basically was an easier way of taking this. So let's say that is a zoom method. That's one line of code. Yeah, I have to like have it as a separate method. It's all the way out. I have to go look elsewhere in my class file to find that. I could bring that in line using the syntax of an anonymous method. And here what we do, it's the same exact code, same exact find all method. But what I can do here is I can use this delegate keyword and say I'm going to pass in a product of T and of type, pass in a product, that's a declaration of variables to input there. And I just take the contents of that method and put it between curly brackets and say I'm going to return the bool of whether the name contains zoom or not. So it's the same thing, except instead of having to have that external method, I can just write this all in line right here in the method. Yep. The predicate of the delegate type. So it's still there. So remember, this is my live code. This is my code I'm writing for my application. If I go back up to here, yeah, so your method has to match the predicate syntax, the predicate signature, excuse me, the predicate signature. Remember, a predicate is just the name of a delegate. So let's just say it has to match the delegate signature. And the delegate we're using is it happens to be this generic one that's in the .NET framework called predicate. So this would be what the .NET framework looks for. It looks at, that's like the, if we looked in documentation, what we'd see what the findAll method calls. But in your actual code, you're just passing in a method that matches the signature. And here, that code we're passing in, the delegate line here, using the anonymous method, this matches that syntax of the delegate. So we can pass that in. Now, we introduce lambda. This is really sneaky. This code here, that was .NET 2.0, this is .NET 3.0. It looks exactly the same. The only thing the lambda really does is take the keyword delegate and replace it with this lambda symbol, which is the equal sign followed then by a greater than bracket. And all I have to do is put the lambda symbol between the input that we're going to put in, which is the product, and the thing that we want to execute, the match test on the right. And that's what a lambda expression is. So in its most basic, all the lambda is just a fancy syntactic sugar to get rid of the keyword of delegate. And you're probably thinking, all right, so why all that trouble to have this crazy lambda symbol if that's all we're doing with it? Well, it goes a little bit further. The lambda symbol gives us some more power because of something else I talked about earlier, which was the type inference. Think back to when I mentioned the var keyword. The compiler can figure out what's on the right side of the assignment operation, so it doesn't need to have it declared. Well, here, we declare that the input value for P is type product, and we're going to return a bool on the right there. But you know what? The compiler can figure that out. It doesn't need to know that, so we can actually shorten this a little bit using type inference and get rid of that. So all I'm doing here is I'm taking the product declaration there on the left side of lambda and the return and the curly brackets, and I'm going to get rid of those and just write this in a single line. It's the same exact code. The only difference is because of the power of C-sharp 3 and type inference, the compiler figures that out. And now that whole line is written there in a single line of code. And we can make it a little prettier, just delete the white space and bring it up into a real single line of code. All right. Smoke coming out of people's heads. Kind of confusing here. So let's look at this though. Now it's like, this looks like foreign code. What is going on here? Well, treat the lambda symbol in this case as the word the English word for where. And let's read this. Let's read this line of code. And what we say is products.findAll P, and P happens to be product. So find all products where the product's name contains the word Zoom. That reads like English. So that's kind of the way you can look at that and say, this is just a nice way of writing the what that we're finding in the find all method. And we're passing that in. Now, under the covers, we know that the find all method is going to call the stuff on the right side of the lambda expression every time it iterates through a loop. But that is what might not have been clear earlier if you didn't know what the find all method looked like. And you probably looked at this saying, what's it doing here? So we're going to see a lot of times in MVC where this type of syntax will happen, especially when you're outputting links to call back in using the action link stuff, which we'll talk about later on from the data in the model. But question? How does it know that P is a product? So if we go back to this point, right? So this here, I'm declaring it. I'm saying it's product type P. And remember, I am still matching the syntax for the delegate, which says take an object of type product and return an object of type bool, because that's the syntax of the delegate, the predicate P that we had earlier. And because C-sharp can do type inference, the compiler can figure that out. It's smart enough to do that. I don't have to write that. I could write this. If it makes it easier for you to understand as a developer and you're writing code, you could write that. But it can figure out that it's a product by examining the value and just inferring it naturally. Because it knows the syntax of it knows the signature of the delegate. All right. So it's reading basically like an English sentence at that point. Questions? You mean in this one? It's the same code, nothing's different. Because the find all method takes a delegate of a certain signature. And the delegate takes a type product as input and returns a bool as output. And because of that signature for the find all method, the compiler can infer that. So these questions are the same questions I had, because I always was like, what the heck? How does it figure out what P is? And why is it the letter P? I could name that letter A. I could go in there and say, actually write the word product on both sides of the lambda if that made it clearer. But general practice is people just write a single letter there to make that easier. So just look at this and think of this in terms of reading that like an English statement there, that it's easier to figure out. What you're essentially doing is plugging in functionality into another method, saying, for the example of this case, find all. The list class doesn't know how to find anything. You have to tell it what to find. So I am passing in functionality that's going to tell it what to find. And it's going to call that in a loop internally. That's what's happening. Yep. if you wanted to pass it a variable. You could do whatever. So everything on the right side of lambda, I have it as a single line of code, so I can write this syntax. If it were multiple lines of code, if we look at this syntax here, see how I've got the curly brackets on the right? I could put a semicolon and put multiple lines of code, and therefore I could pass in variables, do whatever I want at that point.
Peter, can you repeat the questions for the online people?
Sure. The question is, could I pass a variable into the right side of the lambda expression? Correct? So you could pass it in, but then the variable you're going to pass in is going to be the value of that variable at the time that in the code, in the context of the main method. Okay? So if inside the findAll method there's another variable with the same name, that's not getting passed into the lambda at that point. It'd be coming from the outside. So in general, you don't do that too often. Generally, you're going to pass in a single line that's going to do some sort of match test. And for the sort method, very similar, you're going to pass the functionality that says, how do I compare two instances of products and figure out which one comes first, and return the product that comes first. That's the syntax that one. All right. So hopefully this made the light bulb come on for some folks, maybe not for everyone. If it didn't, because it takes a while to get your head around this, I will give you the short and quick answer. So if you don't want to understand the theory of what's going on with the delegates, or you don't get that now, you can always figure that later, just know this. Giving some input on the left side of the lambda, whatever is put in, do with it on the right whatever it says. Do whatever it says on the right with the input you get from the left, and return that to whoever's calling. And be aware that this expression may be called at any time in the future by the code that you're passing it to. You're basically just passing some functionality into another method, and it's going to call this code one time, 100 times, a million times on its own, and do what it says there. Question here? Question is, it's like an inline function. That's exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is. It's an inline function there. Any other questions? Let that sit in there and sit for a little bit. All right. So let's move on a little bit here. So another feature is language extensions. And we have the ability to create extension methods in C#. This is something that I don't know how much we're going to see demoed today, but it's something that is used also in MVC extensively. It's an option. So think about if you have a class and you want to add methods to it that don't exist. How would you do that before? You could create a subclass and add methods to it. You could inherit from some sort of common base class and add new methods to it. You could create a partial class in C# if you had two files and extend it that way. But those all have limitations. For a partial class, if you're going to create a new C# file and start adding methods that way, well, both halves of that partial class have to be in the same assembly, which implies you have control of the code. If you want to extend an existing class, it assumes that the class is not sealed, and also that you have ownership for that DLL. But maybe you don't want to do that, so you've got the ability to extend regular classes with what's called extensions. And what you can do here with extensions is basically create your own namespace, your own assembly, and take any common type out there in the .NET framework or from somewhere else, and just add methods to those object types to extend it. And then when you use it, you just have to add a reference to your extension library, your extension DLL, to your code. So in this case here, we're going to create a class called extensions, and we're going to create a concatenate method for the .NET string class. So very basic thing here, we're going to extend the string class in .NET framework. And we create a signature here of what we're going to do with it. And then, excuse me? Oh, yeah, sorry, my bad, yeah. Thank you for that, yes. We're extending IEnumerable string here. So that's, we're passing the this keyword. So this is the class that we're extending. And it, we're going to add the concatenate method to it, and it's going to return type string. So, yeah, we're passing in an enumerable collection of string, essentially, there. And now, if we want to use this in real life, in our code, we have to put a using statement into our extension library there. So that brings our extensions into scope. So they're not always available unless you actually include your DLL and put the appropriate references in. And then, here we create an array of strings. So this is obviously an array of strings is enumerable. And we can add or we can concatenate things to it. So here we want to concatenate by adding on another comma. And then return back the list of strings, the single string we got back. So it's a way of calling things in line that you can extend. So think of it this way. What you're going to see later on this afternoon are these things called HTML helper methods. These are things that help you render HTML so you're not there writing input type equals text yourself in the view pages. You can call HTML dot and HTML dot dropdown list or HTML dot label or different things like that. Well, if there's one that you don't have, you can write your own extension method for the HTML helper class, and it's almost like you write your own web control. You can write a package of a bunch of HTML you want to output as an extension method. And now, when you're coding later on, you can say HTML dot, you know, my custom control. And it will output a bunch of your own custom HTML that you've packaged up. So that you can write that as an extension method. And it's an extensibility point in MVC framework that makes things easier for you that way. And, oh, by the way, when you do this, you get IntelliSense on all the code that you extend. Does an extension method get access to private data of a class? Good question. I'm not sure. No, it does not. Static method. So the question was, can an extension method access private data inside of the class that it's extending? The answer is no, it cannot access private or protected members of the class, only public members. So another constraint you have to think about there. All right, so we're going to get ready to wrap up. I have two more things to show you here, and then we're going to cut over to the next session. So LINQ, Language Integrated Query, is this ability to write SQL-like code to query your data objects that might be in memory or all different data sources that are out there. So you can query against something like a collection class, against a relational database, against an XML file. Language integrated query is extensible. So people have written LINQ libraries so that you can write SQL-like syntax to query all sorts of things, like web services. I recently read about LINQ to Bing, so you can write a LINQ query against our search engines. There's all sorts of things out there. And you know some things being used in ADO.NET data services and REST. You get deferred query evaluation, so it doesn't actually execute the LINQ statement until you've gotten to that line. Let me just show you some little screenshots of code here. LINQ to XML and LINQ to SQL are two of the more popular ones that are used often. The first one is allowing you to go against a database. And I realize for the folks in the room here, the text is a little bit small, but essentially we load up an XML document into memory. And now here we want to create a list of products, and we do a LINQ query on that XML data. We basically bring back a list of products that match a certain attribute there. The LINQ to SQL, I'm going to skip that and show you the next example. Let's go back to our Zune example. So you saw me write that, passing that lambda for the findAll method. Well, you know what? I don't even need to use the findAll method anymore. I could just use LINQ on that same object. So here I've got that list of products that I got back the product list, which assume had all those products in it. And now I can create another list of products called Zoomed, and I can do a LINQ query. I could say from P in products, and from P, that would mean an individual product in products, look for where the name contains Zoomed, and then select P. So bring me back all the ones that contain the word Zoomed, and it'll populate that list with the results. Unless I did what there? Oh, on the after select, I should. Yeah, you're right. You're right. I should have done two lists there. Sorry. So I am missing a piece of syntax from the slide here. So, one minor point. But the key point takeaway here is instead of that, you could write that type of code where it's more human readable, looks like a SQL query, it looks more intuitive what's going on. All right, so we're going to wrap this session now and get ready to go to the next session. No, hold on. I got to go to this router session. Did it? Oh. Oh, okay, then run. I thought I was done at 11:30, so I will keep going. I did have one more thing. I'll show you then. All right. We're trying to keep to the time schedule to respect the folks who are watching online, too, because we're recording the sessions and breaking them up. So let me show you one more concept here that is an optional thing. We're not going to go too much into depth today, but I do want to explain the point to you, the concept, so that if you want to follow this up later on, look at it. And this is the notion of dependency injection. When I say dependency injection, how many people know what I'm saying? Okay. How many people are saying, what the heck is he saying? Okay, good number of people, and that's fine. So this is not mandatory, this is not part of the MVC framework, but from a lot of folks who are doing MVC development, it is becoming a good practice that a lot of folks are starting to use. It's a very common thing to use within the MVC framework, and we'll talk about later on in the controller section, my next session, I'll talk about where you might use this. And I will give you a point to where to go look for more data on it, but we're not going to show you samples on it today or anything like that. But let's think of it this way. Steve talked about what the three major parts of the model view controller are. We have the controller, which is this main C-sharp class that handles your request that comes in from your web pages. And then it goes ahead, calls some back-end database, calls your back-end business logic, does whatever it has to do to retrieve the data in the model, and then it hands the data of the model off to the view, which happens to be that ASPX page that actually renders the HTML. Well, the product controller, if you think of an N-tiered architecture, where the whole web application, the whole ASP MVC web application is your presentation layer, it's going to call into the back end. It's going to call into probably some sort of business layer, which might call into a data layer, so on and so forth down the line. Well, those things that you're calling into are dependencies. So your controller class happens to be the class that's going to be calling those back-end components. Maybe it's an external service. Maybe it's a business layer. It's dependent on those. So think about how you would write that code. Somewhere in the controller, you have to instantiate an instance of that back-end component that you're going to call or that external service. So in this case here, I might be calling a checkout service behind the scenes. So somewhere in my code, I actually write, you know, type checkout service equals new type checkout service. You know, I write some hard-coded line of code like that. And that's concrete dependency because if I ever decide I need to change that service or point at a different service or something like that, I have to go back in and modify the code in the controller. And that makes it tough for me to do things because it introduces all sorts of things that makes it hard for me to be flexible. So I have to go compile, I have to retest everything. It can get a little messy. So with dependency injection, it's this design pattern that lets you make things be done a little bit more flexible. So the first step to doing that would be for any of these back-end services or next layers you're going to call in your application, instead of calling them directly, turn them into an interface and call the interface of that service. So in this class, this case, I might have a checkout service. I can create an iService interface to represent all the methods that I'm going to call in that back-end service. And the only thing my product controller has to know about is the iService interface. And then what I can do is, in the constructor of product controller, I can new up an instance of the checkout service because it implements the iService interface that the product controller knows about. And that gets me a little bit more flexible, but I'm still writing something hard-coded in my controller to do that. So the ideal world when it comes to this, and the name where this comes from, dependency injection, is let some other code tell the controller what the dependencies are. Let someone else inject that dependency in. So the product controller doesn't know that he's going to talk to the checkout service. He just knows he's going to talk to an iService. Let someone else that's doing the initialization send the checkout service into the product controller. And the way you can do that is in the constructor of the product controller class. You can take as an input parameter an instance of the iService, an iService object as something that's going to get passed in. And then other codes will call that in. So looking at that in a way here, same thing. The product controller knows about iService. That's the method it's going to call. But there's some other code. And in this slide here, I use the word assembler, someone who's going to pass in and set things up. But the word that you'll hear in common out there are these things known as dependency injection frameworks or inversion of control containers, IOC containers. That's a word you might hear a lot, and there are several of these out in the marketplace on .NET. There's at least 5 or 6 of them. There's one that Microsoft makes called the Unity framework. It's from the Patterns and Practices team. You can get that off of CodePlex. There's things like StructureMap, Spring.NET, Inject. There's all these other frameworks that you can use. And all they really do, if you think about it, if you just want to not focus too much on it, is their configuration. They basically wire up and will tell the product controller which instance of the service to load up, so the controller doesn't have to worry about that. So within MVC, it doesn't do that by default. But if that's something you want, if you want the flexibility in your code so that you know you can swap those things out later, there is a mechanism we'll talk about that lets you bring in dependency injection containers, basically an outside configuration utility that's going to load those things dynamically at runtime by passing it into the constructor of the controller. And that way you're not hardwired to the back-end service that you're going to call. Thoughts? Questions? Without wiring in an IOC container, you're restricted to no parameters in the constructors? No. You could pass in whatever you want, but who's going to call it without having a...
At a minimum, if you're not going to use an inversion of control container, the only way to get arguments into your constructor is to build your own controller factory. Okay, so inside your controller factory, which part of the application infrastructure we haven't really talked about much, but
he's jumping ahead of me.
Yeah,
okay.
But
we're going to talk about that later.
So MVC has a default controller factory, which is able to basically match, you know, home with home controller and give you that object back. It's what's really returning the new instance of home controller to the framework. So if you want to pass arguments to that constructor, the only place to control that is from inside the controller factory, and you're either going to do, you know, worst case, which is hardwire them up in there, or that's where you're going to invoke your inversion of control container. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. We're going to cover that in the next session, so I'll hold that comment before repeating it online. So, yeah, we're going to talk a little bit more about it. But I just wanted to cover what the concept was, what we're talking about. We're talking about just dynamically being able to load or have an outside utility plug things in so you're not hardwired. So the question is when to use this, when not to use this. For the folks who are looking at this and saying, what the heck is dependency injection, the answer is probably not to worry about using it today. All right? That's going to be my simple answer. That being said, don't ignore this. Do check it out and look into it. In general, I'm going to say it depends on how big and how complex your application is. If this is just a really simple application that's doing some simple stuff, not going to be subject to a lot of change, then you know, not necessary. Just learn how the framework works. If you're building a big site that's going to be talking to lots of different back-end services, doing a lot of crazy things, it's going to have a large team of developers working, then this is something you definitely want to at least examine and look into. Question? So the comment from the audience was that logging is a common scenario where you might use injection, where you might create a logging component and then have a DI container pass the logging component into the class so that the class uses that logging component on the fly. Uncoupling for testing, that's another big key point, and we'll talk about that a little bit more too. So let's hold off on more on DI until we actually get into the controllers, and then I'll show you more where it would be used in a real world scenario with MVC. And I'm sure there'll be more questions at that point. Any questions on the lambdas or any last stuff on the C-sharp syntax that people might have? We can go back and talk about that for a minute or two. All right, so it sounds like everyone's ready to move on. Any comments from the peanut gallery online? Oh, okay. Any good ones that we want to share with everyone here live?
Well, one person wanted to know whether or not an inversion control container could be thought of as a factory. And the answer to that is yes, and usually with some intelligence behind it to make smart decisions about what to instantiate. Otherwise, there were some questions about whether or not there would be anonymous methods in VB. I'm sorry, anonymous types in VB. And I believe the answer is presently not today, but planned for VB10, unless you have another answer. Supported now? I'm sorry, not on the, this was, so I'm making the same mistake that I did online, which was I first answered that question about anonymous types. The question was actually about anonymous methods, I'm sorry. I can do an inline delegate, but I can't do it as an anonymous method. Yeah. Oh, really? Partial anonymous method. Semi-anonymous method?
All right. So we're going to move on right into our next session.